Not long ago, I had an experience that showed me the importance of leaving a dream immediately. I dreamed I was on the second floor of a two-story building. As I glanced out of the window, I saw a little boy playing high in a tree. As I watched him, the branch upon which he was playing broke. The branch didn't break off completely, but it was still attached to the tree. The little boy clung desperately to the branch, swinging back and forth. I rushed to the window, threw it open, and called out to him, "Do not be afraid. You cannot fall. You are in the arms of love. God loves you. He holds you. He protects you. You cannot fall." No sooner had I finished calling out these reassuring truths than the branch pulled free of the tree and carried the little boy with it to the ground. I rushed downstairs and out of the building to see what I could do to be of help. I was greatly disturbed with the condition of the child as he lay on the ground. Then I awakened. How grateful I was that this experience wasn't true. I thanked God that it had only been a dream. Then I rolled over to go back to sleep. But I didn't go back to sleep. I kept seeing the picture of the little boy falling. I wished he hadn't climbed so high. I felt a great concern over the injury he had suffered as a result of the fall. Finally, I actually found myself wondering why Christian Science had failed to save him from falling. It was then I realized what I was doing. You see, I hadn't left the dream. I had recognized it as a dream, but that hadn't been enough. I truly needed to leave it. Here I had been worrying about something that had never happened. I had been concerned about a boy who was never up in a tree, much less had fallen from one. I had been disturbed from the effects of a fall that had never taken place. Wasn't it ridiculous that I had gone on living in the dream, even after I had awakened and recognized it as nothing but a dream? But of course, the height of my folly was wondering why the truth hadn't worked in a situation that had never taken place. No, it wasn't enough just to see the experience for what it appeared to be, just a dream. I needed to go beyond that in my thinking, see it as nothing, absolutely non-existent, and then leave it as such. Thus, I rejoiced that there never had been a dream, for there never was a mortal mind to dream one. I fell asleep. The next morning, I couldn't help but draw some conclusions from this experience. Very early in our study of Christian Science, we learn to recognize problems as unreal. We call lack, sickness, death, accident, and so forth, error, illusion, a dream, mesmerism. But do we treat the problem as a dream or an illusion? Don't we often go on thinking about it, wondering what caused it? Don't we worry about it, speculating on what others think about it? Sometimes, aren't we even guilty of wondering why Christian Science hasn't worked? In dealing with physical problems, Mrs. Eddy has taught us to leave the dream by taking thought away from the body and turning our full attention to truth and love. You will remember the experience of the woman who had been in a serious accident and been run over by a truck. She left her dream by facing reality. Isn't one who denies the error and keeps a single eye on God's testimony and argues only from the point of perfection, successfully leaving the dream? One of the most significant and powerful truths which enables us to leave the dream and awaken to reality is the simple truth that there is no mortal mind to dream a dream. Where does a dream come from, anyway? You say it is a product of mortal mind, but what is mortal mind? Since God is the only mind, can there be another? Over and over, we are taught that God is the only mind, the most commonly used statement to that effect being the one used in the scientific statement of being. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. Over and over, we are taught that God, being the only mind, there can be no other mind, hence no mortal mind. My favorite statement as to the non-existence of mortal mind comes from the textbook. Quote, "Scientifically speaking, there is no mortal mind out of which to make mortal beliefs springing from illusion." Close quote. Thus, our conclusion must logically be that because there is no mortal mind to dream, there can be no dream. What then should we be doing about the dream of mortality? There is no more truth in your being a mortal than there is in a little boy being up a tree. There is no more truth in your suffering penalties in mortality than there was in a little boy falling from a tree. There is no more truth in your failing to get results from the application of Christian Science than there was in the failure of truth to save a little boy from falling from the tree. Then, are you satisfied to call mortality a dream and go on living in it? Indeed not. We are going to leave the dream for joyful waking now. Moreover, it is easy to leave the dream because we know that even the dream of mortality does not exist, for there is no mortal mind to dream it. Our joyful awakening has been the glorious experience of immortality brought to light in our consciousness. We are going to face the reality of immortality and rejoice in it and live it. Then there are those who say we are really immortal, but man is mesmerized or hypnotized into believing that he has been born into matter, lives a material existence, and will die or ascend out of matter. But how can there be mesmerism or hypnotism when there is no mortal mind to hypnotize or to be hypnotized? We are told in the church manual to defend ourselves daily against aggressive mental suggestion. What more aggressive mental suggestion is there than the belief of a life apart from God? We should be denying consistently the error of a material history. As has already been pointed out, if the angel in Revelation were to stand on but one foot, he had better stand on the foot which holds in subjection the subtle belief that man has ever experienced a material birth. A sure and certain way of destroying any mesmeric belief is the understanding that there is but one mind, God, and that the infinite mind is our mind, yours, mine, the mind of the whole universe. Where, then, is there a mortal mind to mesmerize? Mrs. Eddy makes it clear in all her writings that the sure destruction of hypnotic suggestion comes with the application of the truth that God is the only mind and there is no other. When Mrs. Eddy felt that it was time to establish a second church in New York City, she asked her good worker, Laura Lathrop, to do the job. Since there were those who were adamant that there should be no second church in New York City, some of Mrs. Lathrop's friends were fearful that as she attempted this assignment, she would be malpracticed upon. Mrs. Eddy gave Mrs. Lathrop this prayer to protect herself from aggressive mental suggestion. Quote, "There is no other mind to tempt me, harm me, or control me. I spiritually understand this and am master of the occasion." Close quote. Isn't that powerful? Notice how Mrs. Eddy supports the truth that there is no other mind with, "I spiritually understand this." Not, "I am going to attempt to understand it," or "someday I will understand it." She claims that understanding now. I use this little prayer often, but I like to start out by rejoicing, "God is the only mind. That mind is my mind, and the mind of my fellow man." Then I follow with Mrs. Eddy's words, "There is no other mind to tempt me, harm me, or control me. I spiritually understand this and am the master of the occasion." Isn't that a perfect defense against aggressive suggestion? It completely annihilates the possibility of any such thing by knowing the allness of the one mind, God, and the absolute non-existence of any other mind. It not only eliminates mortal mind as power, but also as a presence. Isn't it wonderful that you are the master of the occasion? Because you spiritually understand that God is your mind and there is no other, you are not mesmerized into believing you are immortal. You are wide awake and alert as to the truth of being. You know who you are and what is going on. Let us rejoice often during the day that we are not mesmerized mortals, but wide awake immortals. You are not even tempted to believe that you are Napoleon. You know who you are. You are not even tempted to believe you are immortal. You know you are the sons and daughters of the King, and you are awake to your true identity. You are not tempted to think you are material, physical, corporeal. You know what you are. You know that you are the brightness of His glory, the express image of His person. You are not even tempted to think, much less be mesmerized into believing, that you live in a material universe. You know where you are. You know that you live and move and have your being in God. And therefore, your universe is spiritual, the universe of mind. You are not hypnotized into believing that sickness, lack, inharmonious relationships, accidents, and so on are going on about you. You are wide awake to the fact that only wonderful things are taking place. You see, hear, feel, and rejoice in a scientific sense of health, harmonious relationships, divine order, peace, prosperity, and life in abundance, because all that is going on is God expressing Himself, and the results have to be good. Isn't it thrilling to be a wide-awake immortal, knowing who you are, what you are, and what is going on? Accept it, acknowledge it, consistently claim it, and rejoice in it. I shall always be inspired by the experience of a woman in one of the Nazi-dominated countries during the last war. One day, without any warning whatsoever, the enemy soldiers took her from her home, along with several other women from her community, and placed them in a prison camp. Already this woman's husband was in a concentration camp. She had been forced to leave behind in her home two little boys who were really too young to take care of themselves. Immediately, she took the attitude that she was not going to be mesmerized or hypnotized into believing that something terrible was happening. She saw clearly that God was her mind, and she realized that divine mind was certainly awake as to who she was, where she was, and what was going on. Never for an instant did she allow herself to be mesmerized into thinking she was a mortal in an enemy prison. She mentally insisted that she was the immortal child of God, boundless, free, dwelling in safety, in the secret place of the Most High. Never for an instant did she allow herself to be hypnotized into believing that awful things were being done at the hands of wicked mortals. She saw the enemy soldiers scientifically as the perfect man of God's creating, expressing only the loving, considerate qualities of God. She even reached out beyond the prison walls and refused even to be tempted to think that there was a war-torn universe where little boys were alone needing care and man was in a concentration camp. Rather, she rejoiced that she was wide awake to the truth that in the universe of mind, the only universe, wonderful things were happening to all of God's children. As a result, one morning an enemy soldier came, opened wide the prison doors, and told all the women to go home. There was no explanation of this act. No situation had changed in the war. The enemy camp was still located at that place. No other prisoners were released at that time from any other prison camp. This woman alone knew why freedom had come to her and her companions. She had been master of the occasion. Because knowing that God was the only mind, she had refused to be mesmerized. You will be interested in knowing that shortly after she was taken prisoner, a neighbor took the little boys into her home and cared for them. Very shortly after her return, her husband won his freedom too. We too can see freedom from mortality for ourselves and others if we will deny that we are mesmerized into believing that we are mortals in a material universe and rejoice that we are wide awake immortals in a spiritual universe, alert to the knowledge that we are children of God, hence perfect. Remember the significant story I told you about the son of the king who never really was a gypsy? As much as I love that story, and as much as I have gained from it in understanding, yet it is not the story about you. May I have the privilege of relating your true history? There was once a son of a king. Because he was obedient to his father, he never wandered into the woods. He never was kidnapped by a band of gypsies. He never grew to look like a gypsy, nor did he take a gypsy name, nor speak the gypsy tongue. He never had to have it revealed to him that he was not a gypsy, but the son of a king. And he never had to be persuaded that he must identify himself in order to gain that which was rightfully his. Instead of wandering off into mortality, you have always stayed in immortality. Instead of growing old in mortality, you have remained ageless in immortality. Instead of having been awakened to the truth about yourself, you have always known you were the child of God. Instead of learning anew of your Father, you have always known Him, loved Him, worshipped and adored Him, and understood your relationship to Him. Rather than having to identify yourself anew as his child, you simply continue to be his beloved son, in whom he is well pleased, sitting on the right hand of God, the Father Almighty. Instead of having to claim anew your inheritance, you have never ceased to be aware that all of God's blessings are naturally and necessarily yours. This description of Jesus is truly your description. Quote, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God. Close quote. That's the end.